knock on any door, you'll find a smile on every face. My name is Matthew Kroll.
And friendly kind of folk who never let you down, my name is Shahir Dowd.
And this is the only podcast about movies, specifically the film No One Will Save You.
I really, part of the reason I chose this movie was to really throw a spanner in the works of our patented approach to have a piece of dialogue from the film open the episode. And I think we found a way around the challenge.
Yeah, guess what? We did it. What's next, cinema? What do you got?
What do you got for us, Brian Duffield? Huh?
Yeah.
You think you can beat us?
You
no.
Got nothing.
What?
Got nothing.
If you haven't seen the movie, there is I guess this is a kind of a spoiler for the movie. Not really, but there is only one line of dialogue in the film. And we felt so strongly about not wanting to ruin the experience for you, we decided not to say what that piece of dialogue was.
Mm-hmm.
But it might get ruined during the course of this conversation.
Well, yeah, we didn't want to ruin it up front.
Well, we could ruin it. I mean, should we go back and ruin it up front?
No.
Should we ruin everything about this movie for everyone?
There is Draculas in this movie.
Oh man, so many Draculas. Really sexy Draculas.
Really sexy. Actually, I'm surprised. I think the working title was actually Really Sexy Draculas.
Who was the, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say the sexiest Dracula was Leslie Nielsen.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say the sexiest Dracula was in Last Voyage of the Demeter.
So I didn't see that. Now, was that Dracula man battish?
Yeah, but again, maybe you're just not into the same things I am.
What's funny is I listened to the episode on Last Voyage of the Demeter because I felt like I could actually get through it because I've read the Dracula book recently, actually. So I knew that chapter and I was very curious what the film did throughout that chapter. Is the movie worth a watch?
I think, I mean, like I said in the episode, I think it is worth a watch. There are things that are done exquisitely and there are things that are laughably bad. But overall, it evens out to a good soup of like, this is an enjoyable film, especially like I'm glad I saw it in a theater because I don't know. I just really dug it.
Yeah.
But I think it also works well for a real good like October streaming at home kind of vibe, too.
How about for book readers who have read the Dracula book and know that chapter well? Is it expand that story in an interesting way?
Yeah, because, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, it's been a minute since I've read Dracula, but you don't, like, learn about the crew members. It's just the captain's log, right?
It's just a captain. Most of the book is...
It's all logs and newspapers.
It's all logs. But you kind of get a sense that it was a bad trip.
Well, yeah, like, but you don't get actual characters. Like, I like the characters that are in the movie. I think the actors do a lot of work to make what would be considered stock cookie-cutter characters, like people you actually care about that feel real in a very fantastical situation.
It's weird because it's like Last Voyage of the Demeter is to Dracula what Alien is to Prometheus.
Or what Solo is to Star Wars.
Right, there you go. Yeah. You know, it's funny, and we'll move on. There's a chapter in the Godfather book that I always felt could be expanded out to be a whole movie. It's kind of like I think it's like 4 or 5 pages where they basically describe the fact that Vito Corleone had to fight a war in New York in order to become the Godfather.
Mm.
And it was when he was a younger man. And in the Godfather Part 2, they kind of sort of started out, but they jump over this period because they sort of say, well, you know, he did this one or two things to become, you know, and he became the Godfather. But there's a really specific chapter about this one war that he had to wage. And I always thought that would be an interesting, you know, if anyone was like offering me money to take on IP, my foolish ass would not be like, oh, give me a Marvel movie. It would be like, oh, what about The Godfather? What about that one chapter in The Godfather that everyone glossed over?
Hey, you know, dare to dream.
Dare to dream,
I dare to dream like our dear listeners who dreamt of the day, of the moment that we would read their emails kind of live across the internet.
I always appreciate emails coming in at onlymoviepodcast@gmail.com. First email came in from Prashant, who writes, I love this, by the way, always, people are always writing us in as they're listening to the episode, which I just always think is great. I'm close to finishing your review of How to Blow Up a Pipeline, the movie, and really appreciate the nuance of the conversation, including the dissection of the Fox News clip. I watched this movie in a packed screening at the Gothenburg Film Festival earlier this year and thought it was an incredibly riveting experience from start to finish. One of my best films of 2022-2023, for sure. Unfortunately, I missed the Q&A session with Daniel Goldhaber at the screening, but the movie was actually recommended to me by my professor. On that note, one of my colleagues at the university has actually co-authored a piece with Andres Malm, and if I'm not mistaken, the book is also part of some courses taught here. I wonder what Fox News would say about those courses being taught. I thought the film itself was a fascinating humanization or personification of the effects of the fossil fuel capitalism. The characters felt lived in, even if a bit on the nose. I do think this is how a lot of young people talk and try to navigate knowledge and politics. This is also paid off incredibly well in the actual execution of The Sabotage, which is also played like the greatest hits of the heist genre. Those are my brief thoughts for now. Look forward to your next episode. Well, you're in it, Prashant. I appreciate the email. I think there is a the other movie I would think to look back upon in this conversation of movies depicting a personification of a social problem. One by Steven Soderbergh, which would be Traffic, and the other by Richard Linklater, which would be Fast Food Nation. I think both those movies are really worth checking out in terms of identifying a personification of a social moire and seeing how it's played out as a narrative construction. Have you had any more thoughts on How to Blow Up a Pipeline?
I've recommended it to like five people.
There you go.
It's funny. I was out with a friend of the show, Chelsea White and Tash Neal last night. And we were going over horror movies. Actually, we talked about Demeter. We talked about a few others. Tash was excited for The Exorcist, next Exorcist movie, which I feel like I burst that bubble a little bit. I felt real bad.
It's the same. It's David Gordon Green, right? The director of the Halloween franchise remakes.
Yep. And then I was like, but there's this other movie that is absolutely not a horror movie that is excellent. And I did pitch this. So I've just been sort of reveling in that. And it seems like a film that, like, even though it was out a little bit ago, people kind of slept on. So I like pointing it out when I can. But thank you, Prashant, for writing us in.
All right.
Next up is Kellen says, hey, guys, I'm pretty late to the party, but I finally rewatched all the Mission Impossible movies. Yay! This was my first time rewatching any of them since the initial viewing years ago. And it's pretty basic and it's a pretty basic and cliche list. Number one, Fallout. Number two, Rogue Nation. Number three, Dead Reckoning Part 1. Number four, Ghost Protocol. Number five, MI3. Number six, Mission Impossible. And seven, MI2. For comparison, while I watched all of these, my partner and her younger brother and sister, who were seeing them all for the first time, the siblings enjoyed them fine, but this is my partner's ranking. And one, Mission Impossible 2.
What?
There we go. There we go. Two, Mission Impossible. Three, MI3. And four, Fallout. five Ghost Protocol, six Dead Reckoning Part 1, seven Rogue Nation. Her reasoning is that the first three are all unique and memorable, while the most recent of the four blend together and are forgettable after a day or two. Thoughts?
This is really fascinating because if you look at these two lists, they are almost mirror images of each other in opposite directions. I think in chemistry, they would call that chirality.
That's right. But it also plays to what she said, right? The first three are memorable and the rest you could put in any order, in her opinion.
I agree with the first part of that sentiment, which is the first three are very memorable. I would struggle to put MI2 at number one, but, you know, whatever floats your boat, I guess.
I dig it. Trashy romance novel. Let's go.
neither of us. When's the next time we're going to watch any of the Mission Impossible movies?
10 years from now, if I'm still here.
All right. Well, let's hope that doesn't come to that. Could you tell us what No One Will Save You will be about? By the way, I could have done a much better segue there going when you said, if I'm still here, and I said, well, no one will save you. So tell us what the movie's about. Yeah. Why did I do that?
We could have. I just want to point out, we could have cut and taken that back and redone it.
Nope,
but now that we've talked about it, cutting and maybe doing that, we're not going to do it because we've referenced not doing it once, now twice.
We're doing it live and everything is a mistake and it's all in here.
IMDb says, No One Will Save You is an exiled, anxiety-ridden homebody must battle an alien who's found its way into her home.
Excuse me, sorry.
I knew nothing. I'm loving these movies I know nothing about. It's so much fun. I tried to not look at sometimes when I'm prepping my notes, I will even blind copy the description and not read it into our notes.
Yeah.
I didn't even do that this time. I just booted it up. I was like, oh, a breezy hour and a half. Let's go. Let's kill this.
Easy money.
And wow, it was a different experience than I was expecting.
What did you think No One Will Save You would be was going to be about when I pitched it to you?
I mean, I have no idea. It could have been anything. And then I did, you know, it's hard not to see the on the Hulu page. You definitely get an alien vibe. And I was like, oh, okay.
Okay, great.
Yeah, this movie does not have sexy Draculas in it. I lied before. That was a fib. No, this movie is about little or big or really big. Blue, gray men, the grays, right?
The grays, that's the, grays,
that's
yeah.
the type of alien we're dealing with.
Yeah, the grays, the big head, darkened eyes, darkened almond shaped eyes, tiny mouth, very skinny, pointy body.
Yeah, yeah. As they're in this movie, it's creepy. It's creepy as hell. And as we alluded to in the beginning of the film, the sort of conceit that this movie has is there's actually no dialogue, which helps the character of. Of what was the character's name?
That you would be talking of is Bryn.
Bryn, played by the normally hilarious Caitlin Denver or Dever.
Deaver? Yeah, I thought it was Deaver.
Deaver. Yeah. Either way, she was phenomenal in Booksmart. I loved her so much in that movie, and it was great to see her sort of stretch her her acting chops here in a very different way, because there's a lot of heavy lifting you got to do with your face and with breathing and with you basically the act of not communicating with other people. And I think she does. I mean, this whole movie is on her back, right? Like, yeah. Throughout the trials and tribulations of Bryn, you never hear another word from another person. If it comes close, it kind of gets cut off. I don't know about you, but once I realized that was the gimmick, about maybe 20 minutes in, I felt like more comfortable.
Okay, so the first 20 minutes you were like, have I turned the sound down? Yeah, is the like, volume going? What's happening here?
Something wasn't registering until I was like, oh, this is the game they're playing. Okay, let's play this game. Like, it was just one of those things where I was like, as we referenced in the beginning, I don't think it's a spoiler to say there is one line. Mm. Not necessarily what the line is yet, but because by the time you hit that 20-minute mark and you realize what's going on, you're like, oh, well, they're going to do a line. Like, I never thought this movie would not have a line of dialogue in it. You know what I mean?
And it would have been great if that line was, aliens, look over there.
Yeah. Yeah. Right?
Okay. But did you like it? Did you enjoy the movie?
Yes. Okay. But you can tell in the tone of my voice that it's not a complete home run for me. Mm-hmm. There are elements I really, really enjoy. I think the alien design is really cool. I liked the stop motionness of their jerky movements felt really neat. Mm-hmm. I liked sort of, it's funny. I liked the mechanics of how they worked or what they were doing. Mm-hmm. However, it also bit too far into like every alien cliche. And it felt a lot like Bryn's journey feels real. Mm-hmm. The alien stuff, because there's so many different permeations that don't even seem to make a logical kind of sense. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, and now there's a different one. Cool. Oh, now that neat. Like, it was just like, it felt like it was stacking trope upon trope. And I thought it could do like with a little bit less of that. And I would have loved a little more like, I don't even want to say like down to earthness, but just like you could lean more on Bryn than the movie already does.
Yeah, the aliens were down to earth right away.
That is very true. Within the first 10 minutes.
Yeah, they're down to earth.
There was something, and I think as the conversation goes on, there's something. There's an internal logic that starts to make less and less sense as the movie goes on. Now, one could argue that the movie in and of itself is a allegory for being a shut-in, for loneliness, for having anxiety, for being a shut-in and a homebody. The way it is structured, 1,000%, that is what Bryn is due to a tragedy in her life. She's kind of limited herself to her home. She builds dollhouses, trying to sort of, because it's something that she used to do with her mother. And like no one talks to her, and therefore no one's talking. Well, actually, here's the weird part, and this is a minor spoiler. The aliens talk. but we don't know what the aliens say. But we do register that they're talking. And actually, there was an interview on Polygon with the director, Brian Duffield.
Brian Duffield.
Who is basically saying, like, he really wanted us only to experience what Brin experienced. He never wanted, like, subtitles on the aliens. And while he does respect really cool things, like, he references, like, Guardians of the Galaxy, like, Groot says one thing. Only Rocket, and then eventually Peter and some of the team could understand it. But even in Guardians 3, Gamora's the one that's like, what the fuck is this thing saying? Like, and those actors got Groot's lines, right? Like, so they knew what was happening. He's like, the only people that know what the alien's saying are me and the sound guys.
Right.
And he's like, and I'm not interested in sharing it. But right. like, there is a narrative sense in there, but he wants people to draw their own conclusions. Which I think is noble, but I think the exercise starts to wear thinner as the movie goes on. Though the ending, as we'll get to, I think is both flawed but very interesting and neat. What about you, buddy? What did you think after your brief hour and 33 minutes?
So I picked this movie because it was getting a lot of buzz on Twitter for a couple of reasons. One was Guillermo del Toro and Stephen King both tweeted about it. I think Sean Finnessy at The Ringer tweeted about it being one of the best movies that it was released this week. And I felt, although there was an opportunity for us to go back to the movies this week, it would be interesting to try a streamer, particularly a genre streamer, which the last film, which was also on Hulu that we did like this, was Prey from Dan Trachtenberg just last year, also produced by 20th Century Fox. So I thought, well, let's see if a boy's 20th C. Fox can give us a 2 for 2. And I think, like you, this conjured a lot of memories in terms of both a sort of interesting approach to storytelling, not unreminiscent of The Quiet Place, or A Quiet Place that came out just a couple of years ago from John Krasinski, and a combination of Fire in the Sky, or even The X-Files to some extent. I think for me, the interesting thing was the filmmaking is exquisite. The actual production value here for what is ostensibly a low-budget movie is really well spent. The design of the creatures is really effective. The CGI, when implemented, is implemented in the right places. And what's, this thing I've always harped on about, which is that the CGI is informed by the filmmaking around it, not just the spectacle of the CGI itself.
Right.
So when we see a large alien, as we do in this film, we are informed by how to react to that alien, even though we know that that alien is a full CGI creation, because of the reaction shots that we have around it, because of the placement of that character, of that large alien within the frame, so that it doesn't occupy the central part of the frame. It is actually the director is doing a lot of work to ensure that the visual effect has the right effect for us. So I think all of that is wonderful. I think the movie kind of ties itself up into a pretzel in order to do this gimmick of not having Brin talk. And I found that in the midway point, there's one very specific scene that really I was like...
The police station?
Yeah, at the police station, where I was like, I'm not sure that the sort of twisty-turny way that we're trying to get to this scene is really paying off in the way that I think we want it to. For reasons that I will get into in a second. But I did think, like you, I think the ending is amazing. I think once the movie finds its stride in kind of being sort of a riff on Home Alone and Sam Peckinpah's Straw Dogs. In fact, I think there's a direct reference to Straw Dogs in here. Then I think the movie really, really works well. Again, I want to caveat that with this note as well. One of the sort of trends we've seen in popular horror, it's not a trend. It is a good guidebook to live by. It's something that I follow when I'm writing as well, which is that the horror should be incidental to the trauma of the central character. So in other words, the central character has to be on a journey internally that has manifested itself through the horror. And I think that's a good rule if you look at The Exorcist, if you look at The Sixth Sense, almost any sure. great horror movie.
Any post-slasher movie horror movie.
I mean, even, like a film like The Descent is yep. is an excellent example of this, which is that, there is an A story which is psychologically driven that is then informed by the B story in an interesting way.
As opposed to like a slasher movie like Halloween, where Michael Myers just comes and causes tragedy. I mean, granted, sequels.
The babysitter murders. You know, I think Jamie Lee Curtis is going through something there.
No, but like eventually, do you know, like yeah, that, the, sorry, sequence, the trauma, yeah. The trauma is told through the story of the characters of the movie, as opposed to something like this, where the trauma is the backdrop and structure for one character that the action that is happening now is mirroring in some way.
And so this was the first film, I think, in a while that I thought that this was an overplayed hand.
Yeah,
That the trauma, while interesting, felt like a device to enable the horror, as opposed to kind of being mutually informed by one another. And I think there, you know, like, so what I mean by that, this is a really tricky thing to say here, I want to say, I really do like this movie. And I think Brian Duffield is a talent to watch. And this is an extraordinary piece of writing. But it is one where I felt personally that was mechanically great writing as opposed to emotionally great writing. And, you know, which is to say, on the page, I can see this all working. Now, there's a couple of things that popped up over the weekend on Twitter, as well as sort of a fun examination of a script page that Duffield had turned in for this particular thing. I think it happens towards the end when Bryn is caught up in a ray. And basically, the whole page is covered in text with her saying, she can't fucking move, she can't fucking move, she can't fucking move. And then every now and again within that page, kind of like, remember in The Shining, All Work and No Play, Miss Jacker, the whole page is just filled with that. And then there'll be like these little boiled descriptors within that big block of text saying, the alien is moving towards her. It's opening its mouth. Oh my God, there's something in its mouth. There's something in its mouth. And it's a really... there's this thing that happens with screenwriting, which is that, you know, we're sort of told that the page should be as stylistically blank as possible in order to ensure that the reader conjures up, or the director can conjure up, the most effective image themselves. But this is using sort of like a really bold stylistic flourish that can't be translated to screen in order to tell a story. I personally love that. I think it's great. Another great example of this, I think in Andrew Kevin Walker's script for Seven, he included diagrams of, the seven hells or something like that in the script, which was, these are things that would be considered big no-nos.
Oh, yeah.
But I think the thing is that if the script is going to production, you know, you need to use whatever tools you can on the page in order to like tell the readers, the producers, whatever, that, you know, how the film is going to work. And I think the page that he submitted was exciting to read and would certainly jump out if you're a reader of the script. The second thing was Guillermo del Toro tweeted about this film, and he talked about one specific thing that caught my attention, which was that from a Catholic upbringing, there is this persistent idea that the way to grace and salvation is through pain and suffering. This is a doctrine that, you know, Guillermo del Toro kind of mentioned as part of his upbringing. And Duffield mentioned that he grew up as an Irish Catholic, and this was something that resonated with him in writing the story of Bryn. In so much as that kind of resonates as an idea, I think look at our discussion of the film Saint Maud as an exploration.
That one's a little more on the nose.
Well, and also a little bit more pointed in its discussion of like, where is salvation lie in that story? So I guess what I'm trying to say here is the trauma and theatrics of the movie are interesting, but I didn't find that they worked in concert with the alien invasion story, which was exceptional. The alien invasion side of this is exceptional. It's exceptionally designed, exceptionally well told, beautifully directed, just beautifully, beautifully put together. But I want to get specific spoilers because I think we've already identified one scene in the police station that we want to talk about in detail.
On that note, and we can get into it too, but I think my point actually won't quite yet, is the trauma. Like, it's weird. Okay, there's three parts of this movie. There's the alien invasion, there's the pre-movie trauma, and there's the gimmick of no lines, right?
Yeah.
I feel like the pre-movie trauma and the gimmick of no lines, maybe even combined with the film's title, mm-hmm. are like linked.
Yeah.
But the invasion, while it does in a way cut her off from the rest of the world, mm-hmm. like even though she's done it herself,
Yeah.
Like there's a scene where she tries to get away in a bus and then there's some body snatching and then she can't get away on the bus. Like, and then she goes home. like, I don't know. There's definitely a bit of disconnect there. And I do think, because there isn't also a lot of like interhuman interaction, even in silence, outside of scenes like going to the police station. And that's like in the first 20, 25 minutes.
I want to talk structurally about a fix that I have for the film for that particular scene, which I think was a real problem for me.
A fix
as in a correction that I want to offer.
Something you're offering to better the film in a Monday morning quarterback kind of vibe.
In my absolute ignorant opinion, by the way.
Okay, great.
Yeah. So let's get into full blown spoilers here to deal with that scene. The issue for me in that scene is it comes after the first invasion.
Yes.
So she has been invaded. Her house has been invaded. She has seen a light from the sky. She has seen a gray man who is clearly not of this earth.
She's murdered him
in her house, and she has killed him or her, and laid its body upon the floor and covered it in a blanket, and in horror, run away from the house that she is in, as you would rightly do.
Yes.
Then she arrives in town, walks fairly casually into a police station where she is greeted by the parents of one of her best friends, a person she has been writing a letter to throughout the movie by the name of Maud. And rather than say anything, the mother immediately spits on her and she
interrupts a line coming.
Yeah, she recoils in horror, and rather than tell anyone about the alien in her house that attacked her in the middle of the night, for which she is killed, she decides to get on a bus and leave town. Now, I think on paper, you could kind of see how that works. In reality, I'm watching going, bro, there's an alien in your house. Like all conversations... all past traumas are off the table.
I think you hit a nail on the head for me.
Yeah.
Inter-character interaction outside of violence in this movie does not make any logical sense.
Yeah.
And I think that is, we'll get to the end, but I think that's another reason why when we get to that last spoiler, while I think the ending is neat, it did not feel rewarding to me, because it's funny. The director is even, and the writer has even gone on as saying they did that ending that we'll talk about as a direct antithesis to like an A24 where like the main character is still like in trouble, beat to shit, dead, whatever, that sort of thing. He's like, no, I wanted a happy ending for my character, so I just made it. And that's not to say that the narrative beats of the story don't make that ending make sense, but it's moments like in the police station when you're absolutely right, Jahir, like all personal trouble, like, because then the police chief and the wife leave and there's two other police officers there that she doesn't talk to and she leaves. So you're
And the mechanic is not, I know she's emotionally scarred by what's happened, but she
It was
not,
movie plot armor.
But she is not like, unable to speak, so my fix would be, I think the horror plays better if the whole film takes place in one night. Right now it takes place over two nights, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to me that there's this interim beat where she goes and tries to tell someone and then decides not to tell anyone and tries to get on a bus, which is then dragged back into the story because, as you say, there are body snatchers on the bus.
Well, it does reveal the body snatchers.
It does, but I think all of that work, like revealing that they take over bodies and what have you, could be done in one night and emphasize the fact that she can't talk to anyone by isolating her even further or doing the police story like outside of the invasion story at the beginning of the film. like doing, like she walks up and she sees the mother and the mother spits on her and then she retreats into the house and stays locked in. And then this invasion happens and we're in the invasion for the rest of the movie.
Yeah. You go like if she reaches for the phone to do 911 rather than it be dead, you like cut quick to that moment with the cop and you're like, oh shit, well, she's not going to do that. Like,
yeah. If she was really emphasized that that was the thing. I think by doing it in the sort of like first night invasion, then she records it. It really, and it is just like you said, a logic thing in the second part, which is like all bets are off the table once aliens appear and like legitimate aliens, you know, like with supernatural powers as evidenced by like the fact that a door handle flies off and hits her.
A
in the
door,
face.
A full door,
a full door. Yeah. Yeah. And these are little, you know, like tiny creatures that have like supernatural powers.
So the other
like telekinetic powers.
The other thing was, and that's kind of what I was getting into. The aliens were varied in every trope. So there was a standard human-sized tall gray alien.
Yeah.
There was the ship itself seemed very nope-ish.
Yeah.
Then there was like a little gremlin one.
Yeah.
Then there was a giant Stranger Things one.
A spider kind of thing.
Yeah. And so I was like, well, and then you have these little body snatcher parasites. And I was like, so what? Like, I was trying to put together the logical situation of what these aliens are, where they come from, and what they do. And a lot of times, like, this is something I'll give even Prometheus or the Aliens series in general. They kind of make sure that whenever they sort of, like, whatever the design for whatever the xenomorph is doing feels informed by its environment and feels like it can be a thing that made sense from where it came from. Mm-hmm. Where these was just like, and they cough up little things that then make you zombie. And there's also ones with super long arms, and there's also ones that look like little gargoyles. And it just, I wasn't like, there was another piece of connective tissue, despite the fact how cool it looked. And sometimes the movement of them made them feel a little Wes Anderson-y.
maybe from Asteroid City, sure.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, that, you know, like whatever the aliens' plans were, I think it had to do with an invasion, with body snatching, with taking over, you know, whatever it is.
So
it's within the context of alien invasion stories.
Sure.
Totally fine.
Let us accept that now. Let me take that criticism I had and just put it on the table, because by 2/3 of the movie, I'm like, you know what? You're right. It's an alien invasion story. I don't need to know the biology and physiology and the whole reasons why. It'd be neat. I'm interested, but sure. Let's just let an invasion film, let's let the Cloverfield of it all wash over us and see what happens.
And I'm totally fine with that.
Sure. I'm fine with it till the end, because then they try to have their cake and eat it too. And so, it was filled with alien jelly monsters that made me angry when I ate it.
I don't know if I got angry. In fact, I thought the end was one of the more successful fusions of her trauma and what the aliens were, what the invasion was doing.
I thought the reveal of the trauma was so ham-fisted. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm talking about the visuals and what we watched happen. Mm-hmm. Felt so like soap opera bad. It was the one moment when I was like, this is it?
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
and I felt that way as well, which is that when it is revealed that what has happened was that as children, Bryn was in an argument with Maud or something like that.
Maud pushed her down.
And she retaliated with the rock, which ended up killing Maud. I like you kind of was like, oh, okay, cool. And didn't feel emotionally tethered to that story.
Because we don't get enough of Bryn, like to make something as straightforward as, and again, the religious connotations you mentioned make total sense with the rock killing a close, like there's the whole, you know, it makes sense. It's a Cain and Abel-esque thing. But like, it felt in a film where we don't know a lot about a character's history outside of like idiosyncrasies or things that she, the way that she acts, to have that very basic concept also be shown to you in a very basic way surrounded by fantastical things,
yeah,
felt misplaced and misguided.
It was, yeah, like, again, I'm offering the fix very, very humbly as a completely ignorant amateur neophyte screenwriter here. But I just think that if we front load the reaction to the trauma being that she doesn't talk, then make it a home invasion over one night, then we reveal what the trauma actually is. I think this plays better than it does if we have a little bit of that trauma, an invasion, then like a little more of that trauma, then back to the invasion. I just kind of think it breaks up the flow and not in a good way. I did like the idea that the aliens recognize that the trauma is such that for this character that they should go no further with her.
I hate that.
Really?
Let me rephrase.
I kind of liked it.
I hate how it's done. I love the concept.
Right.
But in this world, in this logical fucking world that they're trying to set up, we are seeing not only Bryn's house being taken, but the entirety roughly of the Earth. There are dozens of alien spaceships in the sky. The entire town is being taken over. And that they go into her mind to see her trauma, and then they feel bad and stop, and then like kind of make her a happy home. That's kind of the end. We can get into the specifics of it. But that rang so tone-deafly untrue. Because here's why. This is what this is predicating on. Out of the entirety of the human race,
well,
this one, hold on, this one, hold on, this yeah. one very ham-fisted scene that we've seen about a girl murdering another girl with the rock and the trauma that she experienced from that is so moving to this alien race who has traveled billions of light years to come and take over this planet or do something to stop and turn the planet into exactly what this one girl wants. Now, that to me, because if they're doing this to people, they're reading minds, they're doing all this stuff, I don't think her trauma is the trauma that does that.
I mean, it could be the case that they only, in her small corner of the world, they have recognized that they don't need to infiltrate her mind because it is so filled with this trauma that it's not going to do any good anyway.
I don't buy it. We're not shown that. We're very much presented.
I'm just suggesting it as an option here.
Sure.
As to why I'm not saying what I'm not suggesting is that their entire plan has been foiled or diverted because they recognize this trauma. I'm saying it's possible that they, you know, like
nah.
I quite liked the ending that she is now the central figure in a dollhouse of their creation.
Yes.
I think that's a great idea.
That is, it ends up in a very cool spot. And if you talk through it, if you just say what happens,
yeah,
it feels really good. And you're like, that's neat. But when I watched it happen, the way it is presented, I had a real like, okay, whatever movie. And I'm like, yes, I like the last shot. I like that she's doing a dance number that she was practicing with like a mail order dance step thing. And the man who frowned at her evilly because she once murdered a girl in the town with a rock. Now is like her dance partner because he's got an alien lodged in his throat. And like she's like it's a dark ending for everyone but her.
Yeah.
And in a way, with what the director was saying, like, that's what he wanted. He wanted this character to have a happy ending, even if it's dark for everyone else. And that concept is awesome.
Yeah.
I just don't think the movie paid that bill before they got to that point.
And I think that's the sort of thing that I was sort of suggesting here, which is that the movie does tie itself up in a pretzel in order to get this idea across. And I'm not sure, you know, like in A Quiet Place, for example, there's no tying of the pretzel. There's basically like aliens hear every, you know, like can hear, react to sound. So don't make any noise. And that's it. That's all you need to know. And then the sort of upping of the ante there is that they decide to have a baby. And, you know, that's a great, you know, as much as people have had fun with that idea, that movie really plays well to an audience in a theater. It really sells. This one, I felt very, like you, I was kind of like, wow, we're doing a lot of work to make sure she doesn't talk. And I think the payoff of why she doesn't talk isn't worth the effort that we've taken to get here. But again, I really want to stress this as well. What I like about this movie for you, for me, for a lot of people, is that it is a discovery. And while it may not pay off in an interesting way, in a sort of like absolute home run kind of way, I like that we found a discovery that, you know, was available to us on Hulu the day I kind of mentioned, let's go watch this. It wasn't like a months of prep in terms of trailers and what have you being released. It was just like, hey, there's this movie. People are tweeting about it. It looks interesting. Let's watch it.
Yeah. Let me be very clear. I would rather 100 of these movies than just one more Halloween remake.
Right.
This is creative. This is a swing. This is interesting, and there are parts that just shine so brightly.
Direction is just beautiful. And also, as you mentioned, the performances are great, and the visual storytelling to get around this mechanic, which I don't think is quite earned, is really exquisite. It's really, really good.
It's funny. I look at what was that shitty Jamie Foxx Vampire Hunter movie we watched?
But I kind of dug. So was it called Daylight?
Day Shift?
Day Shift.
Night Shift.
Yeah.
I don't fucking remember.
Yeah, yeah.
I think of things like that, and I'm just like, okay, whatever. Like, this at least is something that, feels original. It takes well-worn territory and makes it something new and creative.
Yeah.
And I really do appreciate it. I also really dig Brian Duffield's vibe. And by that, I mean in everything I've read about him, he just seems super chill with letting the world talk about his movie.
Yeah.
There's something when they're talking about, there was a thing about did the stuff really happen or did it not happen? He's like, oh, yeah, it all happened. There's a moment in the movie where there's a part that isn't happening where the line happens.
Yeah.
And then she snaps back to reality, choosing this horrible pain than living in a fake world, even though that's kind of what she's doing and what she does in the end, which then kind of falls apart. But my point is, he says something that says, I dig that people have those conversations and journeys, and I'm open to being wrong about my movie. I'm happy if everyone is like, you're an idiot. This is what actually happens, because it's everyone's movie now. That's part of sending the kid off to college. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
And it's such a healthy vibe.
It's great. And it also, there's no part of this, no part of anything that we've talked about or had problems with that makes me go, if I was an executive, I would absolutely greenlight whatever he's got coming next.
Yeah.
I am on board the train and ready to ride it out. Even if I had issues with this first film, those issues are not, so mired by the actual film itself. It's just a sort of I think from a emotionally resonant point of view, this could have been done a little differently, but I'm also going to say this. What the fuck do I know?
Yeah. Here's a question. I have a question for you, because I couldn't tell when I watched it. When we're in the flashbacks, when the aliens are in her head, and we're seeing The Rock.
Yeah.
In the next scene, we see current day Bryn sitting at a table across from a young girl and touching her hand. Mm-hmm. Was that young girl young Bryn or young Maude?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
Because they looked really damn similar, even though Maude is supposed to have red hair
because
the whole scene is kind of red, so you can't tell.
I think I would have to go back and rewatch it. At the time I was watching it, I felt that was a young Bryn.
Me too. But everything that I've read says, and then she saw young Maude and she forgave her. And I was like, I don't think that's what happened.
It doesn't, but I think if it's young Maude, the scene works. If it's young Bryn, the scene works.
I think if it's young Maude, the scene doesn't work. And I think if it's young Bryn, it does work, because the truth is I think that if the most beautiful thing the aliens see is this woman's pain that she's going through and a forgiveness of herself, because again, the title of the movie is No One Can Save You.
Yeah.
The continuation, or No One Will Save You. And then the continuation of that quote is But Yourself. The young, having Bryn and young Bryn sort of have a forgiveness moment of she's forgiving herself, because this entire movie's been about her relying on herself.
Yeah.
And then the aliens being so moved that they decide to put her in her own little dollhouse.
Yeah.
Makes more sense to me. Because sure. She has nothing to Maud needs to forgive Brynn.
Yeah.
But, in that other
know,
one.
Psychological Maud. Like, you know, right, internal but psychological in thing, Maud.
Current day Brynn puts her hand, I believe, on the young person's hand. So, like, it's not the other way around.
That's not a movie breaking moment for me.
It was a confusing moment. I was just curious how it read to you.
Yeah, I thought it was that. I'm now thinking about like the alien administrator who's constantly getting calls from his supervisor down on Earth being like, hey, this one over here, let's leave her. And then like he goes to the next door and she's like, well, this one stubbed her toes while gardening. Do we really need to overtake her? I think she'll be cool if we just leave her alone. And then go to the next place and be like, yeah, this police chief isn't getting his pension paid out. You know, like, can we just leave him? You know, like everyone's just kind of like finding an excuse for every single person.
There is a like, lot of tragedy. And also, okay. Here, the aliens have orchestrated this whole deal, this invasion of the planet. And then this one team is like, oh, man, we really got to like set up this dollhouse, though, because this girl's real sad. It feels to me like the executive producer that just wants to put their stamp on a project for no fucking reason. Like when we're working on a show or something, we're like, yeah, but like, what if we like turn that like purple? And you're like, I guess we have this whole plan. Are you sure? No. It's going to be cool. It's going to be cool. So they can say like, that's their note. Like it felt like that alien is that producer that wants to make one note of the invasion. Be like, yeah, the invasion was cool. Went off without a hitch. You see that dollhouse thing I set up though? It's like, oh, the one that costs resources and does nothing. Yeah. We see that, Steve. Like, I don't know. Yeah. That's what it felt like.
Yeah. And I'm like, I like that. I like the idea that there's this one executive alien who's just like fucking shit up and up somewhere. There's like, you know, when we saw the alien ships at the end of the movie hovering above, they're like, yeah, did you hear what Steve did over there? Yeah, great.
Like, good. Another bleeding heart liberal.
Design of the ships. So cool. Like, you know, using every trope in the book in terms of a flying saucer.
Yep.
But like really, really cool in the fact that each component of the saucer can move independently of itself and it creates a tractor beam. The idea that the aliens communicate to each other with these loud screeches, wonderful. The fact that if you look at it as an overhead shot over the entire town, you see exactly where the aliens have landed because grass hasn't grown in these spots. Cool. Kind of like these like sort of misshapen
crescents.
Crop circles. Yeah, you know, like that sort of thing. I love it.
I loved that the tractor beams were only calm and like and light touching.
Yeah.
If you were like, if it struck you, if it started and half of you was out of it, it fucked you up.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
It was just like a really cool, like, oh fuck, that's how it works.
It's really rad. Yeah. Like it's super cool. Really well executed. I think the sort of trilobite sort of shape thing that goes into people's necks and controls them through that, I think really creepy and cool. And the idea that once it's inside of you, it makes you think that nothing is wrong and, you know, like kind of gives you this alternate life where nothing has happened. I think that's really, really great. I'm not exactly sure how she pulled it out where nobody else did. You know, like she managed to actually reach down into her throat and pull that one out when nobody else was able to do it.
Maybe she's a messiah figure for them. Maybe she's the one that was prophesied to not do it. And that's why they give her own little dollhouse. Who the fuck
the
knows?
The one who keeps saying the name Maud shall be the one.
It's like,
we shall save us.
Are you saying I can dodge bullets?
Yeah.
I'm saying eventually you won't have to. She's literally Neo.
Yeah, yeah.
To them.
She's the trauma Neo.
Yeah.
Trauma Neo.
Yeah.
Which, you know, again, it's fun to talk about. I think that, the problem of the movie is that emotional beat doesn't quite land or work. But that's not not to say that this isn't a great funhouse ride for the fact that it is, you know, other than Nope that came out last year in A Quiet Place. There are very few movies that play within this space. would have been great to see this released on October 31st or something like that. But, you know, gets out of the way of Halloween Resurrection, Halloween Revisited. No, sorry, The Exorcist Resurrection or Exorcist Revisited or whatever it is. Wholeheartedly recommend it.
Same.
Even with my caveats that once you've seen it, I think it's fun to discuss the issues that arise because of the logical play that these movies are. And again, I just like, I really was just like, you're really going to tell me you're going to tell nobody about the fact that you straight up murked an alien last night. And then she is like Arnold Schwarzenegger in Predator at this point. Like, she is like straight up killing aliens.
And she the only kills 2.5.
Yeah, and I would have been like, the aliens might have just been like, hey, Steve, like, Steve, we're not letting this one go.
The first kill was such a cool moment because it wasn't due to her skill. It was like due to like in the moment crazy physicality happenstance. Yeah. Like the way the alien was spinning her around like quick, like it's doing the entire, like using its telekinesis, but she was holding the top of a model with her arm outstretched and it happened to be the right length and it slammed. Like it felt like the most like accidental, perfect nat 20 death. And I was like, cause like she didn't do it, but she did it.
And also the aliens who have these like extraordinary powers can't tell when somebody else is in the room. Which I thought was hilarious. You know, like there's someone breathing in the room, knocking over furniture, and the alien's like, well, what's that? Like,
yeah, there's a lot of velociraptor brain going on.
Yeah, despite the fact that they can, like, they have telekinetic powers and can, like, and have mastered space-time travel.
Yep.
It did feel like, what's going on here, guys?
Yeah.
but I dug it. I would thoroughly recommend it. And I watched it on the projector late at night. Lights out, and at a sweet 90 minutes, I was like, yep, sold.
And I gotta, again, Caitlin Dever is so fucking good. Like, what an awesome secondary movie for me to have seen. It just shows the range. Like, Booksmart is intrinsically excellent.
Yeah.
And this movie her performance is wonderful in a very different and powerful way. Like, I just, I don't know. I'm looking forward to seeing what she does next.
Yeah. I like her, like the character's grit and determination, but is also like punctuated by the fact that she's extremely vulnerable.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, like they don't fully Linda Hamilton her. And
she doesn't Sarah Connor it at all.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. She's like, she's vulnerable, but she's like determined to not get fucked up.
Her moment of that, the only thing that was close was when she like grabs like hammer and nails and you're like, oh, she's going to fortify. And she just puts up a blanket and pushes the couch in front of it. And I was like, all right.
And then the aliens like extract the nails. I was like, guys, that's a curtain. You can walk through it.
I kind of like the idea that they don't know that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
But then they use their telekinesis powers to like to take out those nails.
What if, ooh, I wonder, here's some reasons. What if that blanket still smelled like dead aliens? So they thought that it was the thing that killed them.
Sure. I would love to have seen a scene extract that idea out. But you know, the more we talk about the aliens, the more they remind me of the killers from Scream in the first Scream.
Yeah.
Where they're like, they're terrifying, but they're also idiots.
Yep.
And, you know, like they do dumb shit all the time. And again, there's a moment, I think, where I kind of started getting into the personification of the aliens in interesting ways, like towards the end, particularly when they look around at each other, having witnessed her trauma, and they're like, oh man, that's really sad.
Oh fuck. Okay. Oh shit. Do we want it, Steve? Don't do it. No. I mean, come on, man.
Yeah. I mean, like, she killed a. Or it would have been interesting if they like were like, are rocks the ultimate weapon in this universe?
Yeah. Well,
like, you know, shit. Like we gotta use rocks for everything. And then they and the interesting thing I hear as well is the aliens seem to be fairly easily dispatched by like knives or you know, like you could probably shoot them.
You just have to get the jump on them.
Yeah, exactly.
Which apparently if you hide around a country farmhouse, or like it's not a farmhouse, it's a country house.
Or if your fridge door is exactly on angle with another shelf in order to create like a little perfect square for you.
That fridge,
they will not know what's going on.
That fridge did a lot of work.
Yeah.
Anyway, this has been the only podcast about the film No One Will Save You. Shahir, when you are not scrambling around your apartment in New York just trying to hide desperately from the myriad of aliens clamoring through your window. Where can folks find you?
You can find me hiding under a white sheet. No, wait, am I a Klan member? No.
I would have gone ghost, but yeah. Okay.
You know what scene just popped into my head is from Fargo when she at the end of Fargo, when she runs out with a shower head yep. and then she's getting away and then she runs into a tree. I was like, that's me. That's okay. me in that moment. Right. At www.shahirdaud.com. That's SHAHIRDAUD.com. Matt, when you are giving notes on this episode with a final hey, what if they just really got on? Where can people find you?
You can find me giving my notes that only exist so I can say I did something on the project over at my website, MATTHEWKRL.com, my life and works. Also, Skeletor, the number 4, Peerezy on Instagram, or PSN. And of course, Emperor MSK on Twitter. Hey, side note, aren't Twitters down?
Should we tell the story?
I mean, if you want to tell the story.
So this is a fascinating thing. Within 10 minutes of each other, because Matt and I obviously have control over the Only Movie Podcast Twitter and then our own personal Twitter accounts, mm-hmm. We got an email at Only Movie Podcast saying that a clip that we put up as Only Movie Podcast a few years ago violated a copyright. 7 years ago, violated a copyright. And then 10 minutes later, I got another email from my personal Twitter account, which said that another clip that was up a few years ago also violated the same copyright. The interesting thing was that the clips that they're referring to are from a music video that I directed.
Right.
With an artist who happens to be a very good friend of mine. And I reached out to him immediately and he was like, what the fuck is going on? He's like, he has no idea about this. He's like, why would anyone put a DMCA strike on something like that? And that was for Automatica, the project, and it has since caused my Twitter account, which doesn't have that many followers, so I'm not super upset about this at this point. I'll try and figure it out.
It's just more points for the Discord.
Yeah, exactly. Is currently down, so I'm curious if it's still down by the time this episode comes out. Tweet at me. I won't respond.
Yeah, there you go. Hey, until then, I'll field Shahir's tweets. You want something to say to Shahir, just tweet at me, and then I'll let him know.
You want to say something to him? You got to talk to me first.
Yeah, literally at this point, I think that's true. Also, please email us in, onlymoviepodcast@gmail.com. What did you think of No One Will Save You? Also, we're still waiting, calculating those Discord messages. We've gotten one or two, but not enough, in my opinion.
Also, got a few messages saying, please do the Bluey podcast.
Really?
Yeah, got a few messages about the Bluey podcast. The Bluey cast.
About Bluey.
My joke back was, happy to do the Bluey podcast, but don't know how we'll keepy uppy with all the episodes.
Wow. Anyway, next week, The Expendables 4.
No. I don't think so.
No, I don't really.
You're on your own, buddy.
No, I don't really. Oh, yeah, wait. Are you around next week?
Actually, yeah. It might be the case that you could do The Expendables 4 because I may not be around.
Shit. Wait, when does The Expendables 4 come?
You know, it's open to the lowest ratings of any Expendables movie and the lowest Rotten Tomatoes score.
You don't say. Couldn't tell from the trailer that was two different movies. When does it come out? Oh, it's out, apparently.
I think it's out already, yeah.
I don't know. Probably not. But who knows? Would that be fun? You know, if I could get, fucking John Gabris or somebody, the other film that's coming out
that's meant to be great is The Creator. The Gareth Evans or Gareth Davis.
Yeah, if you want a good movie.
Tell me what you want.
I have no idea. I don't know. It's either going to be a great movie or a terrible movie next week, and you're going to have to tune in to find out.
For everyone listening in, check out the font that was used on the titles of The Creator and tell me that it doesn't look exactly like the font from The Aviator. Because I'm pretty sure it does.
Yeah?
Yeah. Look at the
font. Oh, yeah, it does.
It's the exact same font.
Things up top look like wings, even though I think they're hands.
It's the same layout. I'm like, oh, is this a sequel to The Aviator?
But then, if it looks from far away, it could be that space movie with Will Smith and his kid. They're dressed similar.
After Earth?
Yeah. They got the cloak and the gun staff.
It also looks like an artist whose name I forgot, but there was a TV show based on his work directed by Mark Romanek. I have a book of his art here. I can share it later.
Man, I really need American Horror Story to shut the fuck up.
Really?
Like, it's all over IMDb right now, and it's just these weird images that don't look fun.
Is it Kim Kardashian is in this?
I have no idea. Kim Kardashian's in it. Cara Delevingne and Emma Roberts.
I have not seen a single season of American.
I saw the first one. It was fun. This one apparently is spider themed.
Okay.
Spiders.
I guess. Spider-Man. Anyway, we'll talk at you next week.
All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye.